take this opportunity to welcome the delegation from the Department of Public Service and Admin, and also convey our apology for having to hold you back for quite some time. I think it happened not till late, but while in the line of duty. We had also Department of COPTA, which had to present to the committee of the intervention in Madibe. Maybe just to make you feel at ease, we are going to have the working session, and as I see all our members enjoying their breakfast while we are still waiting. We have just agreed that we would allow it, because immediately after this meeting, 2 o'clock, we are going to attend the plenary. So without any waste of time, allow me to quickly ask for people of record, the introduction of the delegation, who is the leader of the delegation. We'll just introduce, or she'll just introduce the delegation from the DPSA. Then we'll immediately kick start with the presentation. Because the presentation has been prepared by the department, we'd appreciate if whoever is going to do the presentation is not going to read, instead he or she would have to speak to the slide, because I think you take ownership of the presentation, unlike where you read for the committee. Bear with us. It's not our intention to put limitations, but we just know what is expected in terms of the presentation. Without any waste of time, let me allow you the opportunity to introduce yourself, then quickly would ask all our members to introduce themselves. Who's the leader of the delegation?
Thank you very much, Chairperson, honorable members. My name is Marshal Asili Fufa, the Director General at the Department of Public Service and Administration. I'm joined in the delegation by colleagues from the department. Next to me is Masilo Makura, who is the Chief Financial Officer at the Labor Department. Behind me, later when we talk about the budget, there are some transfers that the department makes, because it's one vote, but there are certain transfers that we make to certain entities. So we have from the Office of the Public Service Commission, Madam Fini Vivian, next to him is the colleague from the National School of Government, which also has a transfer from us. Dion Potreta, who is the acting head of the branch that is responsible for training, policy and planning at the National School of Government. Behind them is the Lozi issue, who is the parliamentary officer for the Public Service Commission. And going to my left, let me start in front here, Metuli Khadebe is the head of the Center for Public Service Innovation, which also has the transfer from the vote that we are responsible for. And behind her, Dr. Mary Lidwama, who is the Deputy DG for Corporate Services in our department. Next to her is Pierre. The next to her. And next to Dr. Redawa is Pierre. Pierre Gornland is the Chief Director from the Center for Public Service Innovation. He works with Metuli Khadebe here. And then the same role as Pierre and Dr. Redawa is Linda. Linda is the Chief Director from the Department of Public Service and Administration. She's with matters relating to planning and monitoring implementation of the planning programs of the department. And behind her, two colleagues also from the department. Shamila is the parliamentary officer, and Namusa is from the office of Dr. Redawa in the Department of Public Service Administration. Let me, Chairperson, also just take this opportunity to apologize for our Minister Chabani, Osana Mbuku, the content advisor for this committee.
Good morning, current members and chairperson. My name is Lana Mashaini. I'm the researcher for the committee.
Good morning. Good afternoon. I'm Kathy Mack, also research committee.
Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Jennifer
Thorpe.
I'm also a
researcher. Dumelang. My name is Moss Manele. Standards that are determined relate to areas such as the functions of the public cannot do, then you are the concurrent of the Minister for Public Service and Administration. Also not to expand that obligation to labor relations, conditions of service and other employment practices. This is perhaps the one that the department is famously known for because of the work that gets done around conditions of service, negotiating on behalf of the state on wage increases for public servants and so on. That falls within the mandate of the Minister for Public Service and Administration. Health and wellness of employees, information management across the public service, e-government, integrity, ethics, the work that gets done around the disclosure of the interest, financial interests of public servants, for example, work that gets done around the code of conduct for public servants, this falls within the mandate, the legislative mandate of the Minister for Public Service and Administration. But we just indicate here that we do not really have concurrent functions as provided for in schedules, the schedules in the Constitution, because our work is cross-cutting, stretching the norms and standards relating to these areas that I have mentioned for the rest of the public service. And in doing that, the Minister doesn't share those responsibilities with other executives. The strategic plans that we have identified for ourselves, one is about promoting an efficient and effective public service and administration, and ensuring that we have a professional public service and administration which is capable and equitable, and ensuring that there are appropriate legislative frameworks in place which can then guide the way the rest of the public service functions. Later, when we get to the actual activities, we'll be giving examples of the kinds of things that we do along the strategic goals that have been mentioned. A strategic goal around promoting an ethical and clean public service and administration, making sure that we also support sound public administration in the continent and internationally. Our strategic priorities that shape the 2014-15 annual performance plan will just indicate what are the things that have guided us in the choice of what we do during 2014-15 in the annual performance plan. One is the strategic plan, as I indicated, which comes to an end in 2015. The national development plan as well. For us, there is a translation of the national development plan into the medium-term strategic framework of government. And you will see later, honorable members, in the kinds of things that we do that give effect to what the national development plan says. And then, of course, alignment with the organizational structure of the department. Just to highlight that Chapter 13 of the National Development Plan for us is quite instructive in terms of what is expected from the department. The critical responsibility of achieving an efficient, effective, and development-oriented public service as instructed by the National Development Plan, Chapter 13, the concerns that have been raised about unevenness in terms of capacity in the public service as a result of a range of factors. Some of the factors include what is commonly known as the problems at the political administrative interface, relationships between ministers and officials, between MEPs and officials, which then end up leading to a compromised public administration in terms of its effectiveness. Instability of the administrative leadership, where instead of having a head of department, for example, being able to fulfill their role for the rest of the contract period that they have been given, it gets interrupted, and that leads to instability at that level. And all the other issues that are raised in the National Development Plan. The key issue here, therefore, is the work that needs to be done, which we will speak to in this presentation, that relates to enhancing morale, clarifying lines of accountability, dealing with issues of building an appropriate ethos of public service, ensuring that there are appropriate structures that support the functioning of departments. These are the things that we've drawn from the National Development development plan and guide what we are focusing on during 2014-15. Again, chapter 18 of the National Development Plan, which I have spoken to, I think here we also adding aspects of chapter 14, which relate particularly to dealing with promoting ethical behavior in the public sector and promoting anti-corruption as well. The specific activities that we embark on during 2014-15 will actually be giving effect to this point that are raised in the National Development Plan. So what are those actions drawn from the National Development Plan? In order to contribute towards stabilizing relationships at the political administrative interface, one of the things that has been raised is that there is no clarity around delegations. The Public Service Act raised HR delegations, organizational structure, service delivery improvement, all this other responsibility of the executive authority. The Public Finance Management Act raised the responsibility of the head of department and accounting officer. But to the extent that you end up not having sufficient delegations from a minister to the department or from an MEC to a department, you end up having some of these challenges that then lead to tensions at the political administrative interface. And our work in this area at the start is to make sure that we create a minimum set of delegations, which then all institutions can be able to utilize so that the issue of delegations does not become a problem anymore. The NDP talks about putting in place a formal graduate recruitment scheme for departments to recruit young talent during the 14-15 financial year. Together with the National School of Government, we will be piloting that formal graduate recruitment scheme. We will also be looking at, as suggested by the National Development Plan, introducing other assessment mechanisms that can be utilized as part of the recruitment and selection process of officials, so that you don't just focus on the interviews and looking at the CV. And of course, putting in place support programs for departments with a particular focus on frontline service staff. And then looking at the entire service delivery improvement planning system as provided for in our regulations to make sure that it becomes more efficient. The last 3 points here to reflect on, one is around revitalizing and monitoring adherence to what will be the program, strengthening the implementation of the financial disclosure framework, the work that we do in partnership with the Public Service Commission, where the financial disclosures are sent to the Public Service Commission for filing, but also they are also interrogated so that areas of potential conflict can be identified. And then also the work that we are doing around prohibiting public servants from doing business with the state, we'll talk about that. Chapter Shomester, we welcome the Director General of the Office of the Public Service Commission, Professor Levin, who has just arrived together with the Justice Wade from the Office of the Chairperson of the Public Service Commission. These are the interventions, Chairperson, that we will be looking at, supporting interventions for service delivery improvement, focusing on improving management of discipline, government as an employer sits with organized labor in the collective bargaining chamber, the TSCDC. They end up reaching certain resolutions and the issues to make sure that all these resolutions are implemented, because if they are not implemented, they then impact on subsequent rounds of negotiations. For example, we are preparing for the next round of wage negotiations with labor. If you still have an outstanding, a huge list of outstanding resolutions that have not been implemented, they then impact on the success of the next round of negotiations. We've come up with a complaints and complement framework, and the issue will be supporting implementation of the framework across the public service, monitoring compliance in the public service to public service regulations. We've also worked on a framework for productivity in the public service, and the issue then will be to ensure that we improve productivity in the public service using that framework as a tool to support departments. Promoting training also, particularly around compulsory and mandatory training in the public service. recognizing excellence. One of the things that we've come up with is the National Battlefield Service Excellence scheme, which annually recognizes excellence in departments in terms of individuals and departments and institutions themselves. And then supporting the implementation of the Public Administration and Management Bill. The bill was passed by the National Assembly last year, the early this year, and was then submitted to the President. Once the bill is signed into law, there will be expectation from our side that we focus on supporting implementation of the bill. Also, having experienced what happens when you put a provincial province under administration through Section 100 of the Constitution. The Constitution provides that cabinet may place a province under administration, but that there should be enabling legislation to support that process. Such legislation has not existed to date, and with the experience that we've had at the moment, we realize that this is the UPL and that we should indeed have a framework that guides Section 100 interventions in the unfortunate circumstances where it becomes necessary to place the province under administration. And then obviously dealing with corruption related cases and the financial disclosures of senior managers. We're talking about an electronic disclosure system here because the system thus far has been manually done. People complete the forms manually and then submit them. It's not ideal for a number of reasons. One is that it's not convenient for members of the public service to conclude manually while they can take advantage of technology. It also makes the job of analyzing, scrutinizing the forms very labor intensive. While if you have an electronic system that is linked, for example, to a range of other databases, the company's registration database, for example, you are able to do the scrutiny much more easily electronically as opposed to doing it manually. I've spoken about the bill already, and what this slide does is it just talks about the key things that the bill provides for. One of the things it provides for is the establishment of the National School of Government. It provides for the establishment of a unit called the Public Administration Ethics, Integrity and Disciplinary Technical Assistance Unit. Here the expectation is that you create centralized capacity, which then gets used to support individual departments when it comes to discipline management. Because the experience has been that this is one of the areas of weakness that we have as a public service, that people can be suspended, the suspensions then don't get followed up with the necessary investigation hearings and sanctions that need to be meted out. Or where sanctions are needed out, usually they are quite lenient. And that's what the unit will be doing. And then, of course, it provides for the establishment of the Office of Standards and Compliance, which will ensure compliance with the minimum non-trip standards. The next slide then takes us through program by program. The key point of focus, the administration one, I will not focus on this lot, but it relates to the work, the compliance requirements that we have in terms of National Treasury, for example, submitting our annual financial statements to Treasury, National Treasury, achieving higher levels of risk maturity in our entities, making sure that the projects that are put in our audit plan, in our annual audit plan, that they are all implemented, ensuring that we achieve higher levels of employment equity targets as provided for in our employment equity plans and so on. We had a section in the EPSA called labor. This is where the work around resolutions reached in the bargaining chamber falls, and the focus is on making sure that they get monitored and are implemented. The agreement that we reached with organized labor for wage increases, which is commonly known as Resolution 1 of 2012, it comes to the end in 2015, so which means for 2015-16 onwards, we will need a new agreement with organized labor, but we want to start those negotiations during the course of the 2014-15 financial year, so that by the time you get to 2015-16 onwards, member of the public is unhappy with the attitude of an employee, can they actually complain not only to government but to representatives of organized labor and say, your members are giving us problems in the hospital, in the clinics, and so on and so on? And that's what the partnership is about, as provided for by the public service charter. There is also work that is being done around introducing a government employees housing scheme, having realized that although the government spends about 10 billion annually to give housing allowance to public servants, that does not translate into home ownership on the part of public servants. And the approach is to say, let's having learned from experiences such as the government employees medical scheme, let's look at a business case here through which the allowances that get paid to public servants can actually be part of a bigger system that translates into home ownership, which has not been the case thus far. The work also will be done around strengthening our remuneration policies in the public service, strengthening our job grading systems in the public service, our human resource development strategic framework in the public service, and something that has been mentioned before, improving the time it takes to fill posts, and also making sure that the vacancy rate in the public service is kept to a minimum. It's work that we do to monitor aid and support departments where necessary. I spoke about the graduate recruitment program, which is provided for in the NDP, and that's work that we'll be doing during the course of the financial year. I also spoke to a person about the delegations of authority between from executive authorities to accounting officers and further down in the department. But currently, just to emphasize the one on organizational structures, because we mentioned that this is one of the responsibilities of the Minister of Public Service and Administration. What has been done here is to develop generic organizational structures for sector departments. So for example, you take departments of health, and the argument is that there is no need for each department of health in the province to start from scratch every time it has to be an organizational structure. If you have a generic structure that then the other provinces can use, obviously taking into consideration their own local contextual differences, but at least having a generic structure that they can use. So these structures have been developed, and the focus will be on assisting the provincial departments to align their individual structures with the generic structures that have been developed. The training part on mandatory training, I have spoken to that already. Towards the end of last year, there is also a framework that was approved by a cabinet called Public Sector Integrity Framework. Here, the idea is to strengthen the manner in which we deal with things such as gifts in the public service, the manner in which we deal with the disclosures of financial interest. At the moment, the requirement is that it's only senior managers who disclose, but with the framework, we're trying to extend the requirement to include other officials as well. And also the framework deals with the issue of prohibiting public servants from doing business with the state. I've spoken about the e-disclosure system, which basically takes the financial disclosure system of government to another level. And then what we'll also be doing is to deal with the issue that is provided for in the regulations at the moment, but where there has been still yet at this stage, where public servants may apply to the executive authority for permission to do remunerative work outside their job. And as long as the executive authority approves, then the public servant can go ahead and do work outside. Now, the issue here is, I mean, the expectation was that when you receive such a request, you do get it and say that this is going to take too much time. This is going to lead to conflicts of interest, and on the basis of this and other factors, this should not be allowed. But that has not always been the case, because where you find people then continue to do business and getting paid, looking at the issue of mobile service deliverers through train houses, where you can have a counter where at each stop that it passes, there can be certain basic baskets of government services that are provided. But we'll be looking at a feasibility study then to see how we can take that forward. And then, in addition to that, we'll be looking at the development of a knowledge management framework for the public service. The concern here is that all the knowledge that people have when they work in the public service, if they leave, they leave with that knowledge, or it's somewhere in the drawer, but there isn't a framework that guides how we can make sure that the knowledge that people have that they've generated can still be of value to subsequent generation of employees in the public service. Perhaps the last point to emphasize under policy relates to work on the provision of reasonable accommodation and assistive devices. We have been monitoring the achievement of employment equity targets, especially in relation to people with disabilities. And one of the issues that has been raised is that you are not able to retain these people or to attract them because there isn't adequate provision for reasonable accommodation in the public service, and the provision of assistive devices that will make sure that you are able to attract and retain people with disabilities in the public service. So that is work that will be done during this year as well. On ICT, the work that we do is about making sure that there is better connectivity for digital service centers, that there is a sound e-government strategy that deploys ICT as a tool for service delivery in the public service, and where we also monitor ICT costs in the public service, because concerns have been raised that the cost keeps increasing, the value that the public service gets has not reached the necessary threshold that then matches the amount that gets spent. I think just perhaps on the ICT governance framework, previously the AG raised concerns that there isn't an ICT framework, a good sound corporate governance framework on ICT that departments can use. And the AG would say, whenever I audit departments, what I find missing is a set of norms and standards that should apply across government departments on ICT corporate governance. And so that framework was developed and was approved by cabinet, and the focus now really is on supporting departments and monitoring the extent to which they are able to implement the framework. Further work will relate to the findings that we do on the geographic norms and standards. We're looking at the distance norms in terms of the distance members of the public travel before they reach the delivery line. We've already done work in this area that looks at social grants, pay points, for example, that looks at home affairs offices, and so on and so on. This time around, we'll be looking at digital service centers and the distance that people have to travel to reach digital service centers and other access services. The productivity management framework, I've spoken to that already. The unit cost issue, I've also spoken to that. Legal services is just ongoing support to the department on matters related to legal services. Our spending up to the end of the 2013-14 financial year, these are the figures. The adjusted budget that we got was 829,731,000, and the actual expenditure as at the end of March was 809,000,000. Leaving a budget of just over 20 million as unspent, but the total spent against the budget is 97.5%. I should just indicate that one of the things that happened during 2013-14 was what the president announced as the creation, the establishment of a presidential commission on public service remuneration. Which commission would then independently advise on the remuneration of public servants. So there was a ring-fenced budget that was put aside for the commission sent to National Treasury. Looking at the final expenditure, but in organized according to economic classification, compensation of employees at 94.7%, goods and services at 96.5%, payment of financial assets at 100% spent, transfers and subsidies at 99.9%, and payment of capital assets at 99.9%, giving the total as reflected in the previous slide of 97.51%. Using the same information but capturing it per program, admin at 104, human resource management at 98, labor relations at 57%. Yes, as reflected, but as reflected according to the program and the transfers that are there at the bottom. Now this looks at the period ahead. Well, we provide a breakdown in terms of the 3 years ending 2014, and then also then provide the figures for the period 2014-15 up to 2017-18. So if honourable members perhaps could look at the 2014-15 column, which shows what the total amount is, 875 million, and then it goes up like that up to 2017-18. 995 million for the vote as a whole. These are the same allocations for the period I've spoken to, but organized according to programs and the functions as well. The figures would be the same, it's just that they are classified differently in this slide. We just included in the presentations that we're giving to the honorable members also, because you see in the budget we talk about the transfers, just also to indicate those entities that are included in the transfer. The Center for Public Service Innovation is one of them, and this is the kind of work that they do around promoting innovation and the mainstreaming of innovation in the public service in the West of the Chairperson, as reflected in the slide. The Center for Public Service Innovation, again, just an elaboration on the activities around promoting innovation in the public service. And entrenching a culture of innovation in the public service. You will notice one of the things they do also is the annual innovation award, where they recognize innovation in the public service. The National School of Government is another one of them. It focuses primarily on training, building capacity in departments, and this just outlines the kinds of things that they focus on in relation to this work. There's an instrument that has been developed and is implemented by the Department of Performance Monitoring and Evaluation called MPET, Management of Performance Assessment Tool, which releases results on the performance of individual departments. What the School of Government will be doing, among other things, is to take those results that have come out of the assessment, and then as part of their training and capacity building mechanisms, support individual departments to improve their performance. And obviously, they are well on supporting departments to attract and develop young talent, and their compulsory induction of new public servants after they have been employed. This is just a breakdown in terms of their training programs, the School of Government, focusing on administration, the compulsory induction program, leadership program, management program, and the total targets in terms of the numbers of people that will be training during the 2014-15 financial year. Also included the Public Service Commission, although we have to emphasize that the Public Service Commission is an independent constitutional body,
presentation, allow me then to allow our members to interact with the presentation. There's the presentation.
First question, the responsibility of Tucson Service Center, is it your responsibility as a department entirely, or is the responsibility of GCIS? I just want a clarity on that matter, because sometimes you might find that GCIS also plays a role there. And then another issue is with regards to performance management. How does the department assist other departments in terms of carrying out their performance management? Is it each and every department's responsibility to make sure that performance management system is carried out, or do you somehow assist that department to do that? Another issue is on you touch base on vacancies within the department, but there are no specifics as to when will those vacancies be dealt with. So I'm just checking with you, because in some instances those critical positions need to be filled for the department to perform and to deliver its mandate. I've got quite a number of questions, Chairperson, will be with you. The last question for now is on issue of minimum wage gap, or what I can say, a wage gap in terms of top management vis-a-vis functional management. When you are with your organized labor, can you touch base on that issue of that huge wage gap that is there? And then I will pause for now and questions after.
Any other question? Honourable member, is that your question?
Thank you, Chairperson. On slide 14, the bottom one, economic classification. I just want clarity on that. The first part of that is a compensation of employees, I would think. The available budget to date, we still have about 13 million in that budget. I think it's basically what brings us to the 97% of budget spent to date. Can we get details on this issue, and also on the 7 million goods and services? What's actually happening there? Are we not employing people, or what's the real deal there? And then, Chairperson, I'll come back with the other one. I'm sorry, thank you. Okay.
Another member, Charlie.
Thank you, Chair. Let me welcome the report, because the other members of the report. My name is only one, Chair, on the issue of the housing scheme, the case, business case that the group presented to the minister, and how far.
like to have the clarity to what framework is put in place by the department in terms of monitoring the implementation of the resolution. That's one. Secondly, can they clarify me in terms of the structure, because in the Eastern Cape, in the Department of Health, there's no organogram because they are waiting for the framework from the GPSA. But if the information that I'm getting is contradictory, because if they are monitoring that, how far have you gone to assist the professors? Secondly, there's this issue of baseline materials of the professors. And can you assist me in terms of aid? If there's this baseline where the posts are advertised and in a certain period those posts are not filled and they not exist within the budget, what does that mean? I would like to understand this issue of ordinary implementers, ordinary officials of public, of Department of Public Service. How far did they go in terms of trying to have a specific policy in terms of housing outside the public sector? Outside the public sector, a specific policy that covers the ordinary officials of the government. Maybe lastly, the effect, because in the last bargaining council chamber, there was an issue which was very discriminatory, which said OSD. Are you phasing out that even that level of payment? Because it doesn't consider the previous disadvantaged
Can I first allow this first round of questions to be answered? Then if there's any follow-up, would allow follow-ups thereafter. Allow me to welcome also the delegation from the Public Health Service Commission. DG, you are welcome and hope that accompanied you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson.
You can delegate. you don't devolve.
Unfortunately, the prescript don't allow one DG to delegate to another, but I think on the basis of collegiality.
No, you have people that can accompany
yeah.
you.
Yes.
So perhaps I was referring specifically to
thank you very much, Chairperson. I'll talk to some of the issues and then invite the CFO in particular to talk to the questions the Honorable Judges have raised around the budget and perhaps also the questions the Honorable Judges have raised around the consultants as well, the slide that deals with what goes to consultants. And then after my colleague, Professor Levine, like to come in as well to assist with some of the issues. Let me start with the issues around the 2030 factors. Because if you trace the history of the 2030 factors, they were actually initially established as information centers. That's where GCIS came in. That those would be centers where communities would go and access a range of information on government services. Over time, it was realized that there is more that can be done through these centers than just information. They actually become the delivery line and so on. And that's where the challenge became, because you have GCIS playing the historical role, which was quite useful. But the moment you then broaden it and then bring Home Affairs, bring Department of Labor, Social, the mandate widens. And so at the moment, in terms of supporting implementation, there's a range of workshops that PPSA runs with departments, particularly provincial departments, on implementation of the PMDS, performance management and development system. Obviously, we become aware of areas where the system is not working effectively. That's why one of the things that we are working on now is to close some of the policy gaps, especially when it applies to heads of department, that there are weaknesses in terms of the way the system is being implemented. So that's the kind of work that that we deal with. I think on the vacancies and the statistics around the vacancies, the progress that is being made, we produce detailed reports regularly based on information we collect from departments in this area. And it might be that perhaps at a later stage we might have an opportunity to interact with the committee on the specific findings, the progress that is being made by departments when it comes to the filling of vacancies. More or less, we're looking at the vacancy rate at any given point in time being kept below 10%. Now, when you take the average, you will see that is being achieved, except that when you look inside individual departments, individual provinces, you see a lot of variations there. But we can interact with the committee on the details of our findings and per province, per department, and the progress that is being made in that regard. The wage gap between top management and the rest of staff. I think here, given the I think the gap actually has been closed, or has been reduced, let me use that word. Because, I mean, if you look at some of what has happened, over time, the wage increases have been done in such a manner that at a higher level, the percentage is lower. Even if you look at the recent round, the officials at level 14 to your chief directors upwards, they got 5.something%. The ones at level 18 got a higher percent. The ones at 12 downwards got 7.something%. And this is something that has been happening over time. In fact, honorable members might be aware that for this is 13-14 for 12-13. That Director General actually has to surrender the increase that they received. So for 12-13, their increase was 0%.
I can see how sympathetic you are.
but it's not a new thing. It's been happening over a number of years. In fact, I mean, again, the actual figure can be provided at a later stage. You will see that somebody who's at level 12, top notch, and another one who is in management at level 18, first notch, and you look at the difference between the two, you will see that the gap has been narrowed significantly. But it's a process thing that the company, because you can't just at one first sheet and say you close the gap completely. But I think it may be useful to discuss it when we even look at the specific figure, because it will show that over time, actually, the gap has narrowed significantly. The question that the Honorable Manabul has raised about the government employee housing scheme, this was one of the resolutions reached between the government and labor on the introduction of the scheme. What was done was there is a joint project between representatives of organized labor and representatives of the state on developing the model. Thus far, there's quite a few things that have been done towards putting the business case in place. There is a framework for the scheme that has been developed, which looks at what would be the different elements. do you go the route like you follow with the government employee housing scheme, where you have a government employee medical scheme, where you establish a freestanding entity to run the scheme, or do you use one of the existing entities in government, such as the ones that fall under the Department of Human Settlements? Those are the options that have been put on the table. The expectation is that as we go into the next round of negotiations for the period 15-16 onwards, that we will have something much more concrete around the scheme and the implications thereof. But I think it links to the question that was raised about what gets done for employees at lower levels in terms of housing. The provision at the moment, and I would imagine the question also deals with the gap market that has been raised in the past, that public servants who earn too much to qualify for an RTT house, but earn too little to meet the requirements for CONI when it comes to commercial banks. What they have here is for those level 10 downwards, they get their housing allowance of 900 rand a month, which is then supposed to assist them when it comes to housing. It can be argued that it's not enough, but that's why discussions around the scheme are coming in, because the issue is not just money, but it's to address a whole range of things which collectively will assist public servants when it comes to home ownership. And if you look at the different elements that the scheme is trying to look at, it's trying to address exactly that. I think on the monitoring of the TSEC regulation, what we have is we have a unit in the department which has a register of all the resolutions. And what they do is that they report periodically on where are we with this, where are we with this, what is outstanding, and so on. But this is work that is done centrally within the Department of Public Affairs and Administration, where there are resolutions that are still outstanding, then they are able to go back to the TSEC and also to report to the minister on those areas that are still outstanding. I'm concerned, I must say, about the organizational structure one, because if a province can't say that we don't have a structure because we're waiting for DPLA. Because in terms of legislation, the authority to develop and approve a structure, it lies with the executive authority. The role that we play is the regulatory and supportive one. Unless they are saying to us they developed the structure, they submitted it to DPSA for ministers concurrently, and the minister has not concurred. But they can't say, no, we are waiting for a structure from the CSA, because that's not the responsibility. And I would certainly be interested in knowing the specific department, so I can talk to the head of department there.
I'm afraid in the Department of Health, we are operating with an internal structure of Oganuka.
Department of Health, we need
yes. Because they are waiting for your I don't know what is your proposed structure, so that they can fit their structure within your proposed legal framework of your Oganuka.
Okay. Yeah, thanks for that. We will talk to the head of Department of Health in the Eastern Cape. I think the one on the money, what is still left and so on, CFO, perhaps before you come in.
To other staff of the department, across all the departments. I'm asking, are you still operating on that framework of OSP?
Yes. The occupation.
You understand what I'm concerned about, the discriminators of each within the department.
I understand.
And certainly, if a
earlier when the OLDs were introduced, that you have categories of employees who you would want to encourage to join the public service and to retain in the public service, and who might not even, for example, specialized legal services, who you would want to retain because there's a high demand of these people out there. But they do not necessarily aspire to become deputy DGs and HODs and so on. So where they are located, the dispensation must be such that it incentivizes keeping them within the public service. Now, I think to the extent that it's implemented in the manner that then seems to promote discrimination in departments, that would then be a problem. It is.
I noted what he's explaining, and unfortunately that means it's a very fair discrimination.
Well, it can be unfair if it's not implemented correctly. But where it is implemented correctly, it is fair discrimination. Where it is implemented correctly. What we do from our side, and I know I think it happens with the Public Service Commission as well, that on an ongoing basis, where people have complaints specific to the implementation of the OLDs in their department, they approach us. And I think with the Public Service Commission, they raise them as grievances, which they then have to pronounce on. And we deal with this on an ongoing basis, where a department will come to us and say, here is this employee, we don't think that they qualify for OLD because of the following reasons. We'll look at the specific case, and where we believe that the employee qualifies, we advise that the employee qualifies. So I think to the extent that there are incorrect instances of implementation, then it is unfortunate, unfair discrimination. But where it is implemented correctly, in my view, is that the discrimination is fair, because the instrument was, it was never introduced to benefit every single public servant, but certain categories.
Yeah, you're then implying that you are admitting that there should have been in terms of the
OSD. That I can deny. That's why I'm talking about the work that we do with department direction to make sure that where there are shortcomings are not implemented.
Well, when I say you want to take it in peace, but the concern that is being raised that is that there is a serious concern in terms of the implementation of issue of OSD. What is the holistic approach that you are coming up with? Unlike where you wait for people to raise their concerns and frustrations of previous system that you think will be getting them a firefight. What is the plan? If there's no plan, what is it that you are envisaging to come up in the future?
No, so I'm not sure, Chairperson, because of the emphatic manner in which the issue has been raised, the process from us will have to be different. That we will then have to look at a much more holistic approach. To address the implementation challenges that exist when it comes to the OSD. Admittedly, the way we have been dealing with it to date has been to say where there are incidents or problems in departments, we intervene. But given how it has been raised sharply, we will have to change our text when it comes to dealing with the matter.
Thank you. Just may I come in, because that's why it's critical. Like we are saying, they must work on it, but they need to prioritize that one. Because of in their program, with regards to NDP, with regards to the capacity. Because I know the background of the NDP is to encourage the employees to make public sector as a choice of employers. And it is said by the President of the National Assembly. Because it's one of the drivers of the National Assembly. The department is also going to include it in the agriculture and to make it a priority in order to be able to be able to address that. Because that's how we build the capacity in the holistic planning. Because also it deals with the engineering sector, it deals with construction, it's all not only with health, different sectors.
The point is well taken, sir.
Yes, to us conclusion.
And well, to us conclusion, I was going to check with the Professor Levine if he wants to comment on one or two of the issues. Otherwise, I'll have the CFO to talk to the issue of the slide on finances.
Yes, there are two issues raised by Honorable General Triggers on the 18 million that was not spent for compensation of employees. This is the money for salaries, which is due to the fact when there's vacancy or vacancy that were not filled at the end of the financial year. Much that was not utilized. As you know, that if you have a person who resigns or transfer to another department for 2 months or 3 months that you take, when you're in the process of filling that position, you will have that saving. 50% of it relates to its for compensation of employees for the commission that the DGL indicated here on, that when the money was appropriated in November during the ISF estimate, the commission could not take off the quickly because there was a change of approach in terms of how it has to work. So there's about 10 million that was not spent by the commission. About 6 million relates to compensation of employees. And 4 million of that relates to goods and services, and which is the other question that you've asked, the 7 million that was not spent, part of this operational budget for the commission. But also from the department as well as program 3, which is PSICKM, there was an amount of 3 million that was not spent, which was supposed to be paid to CETA. But due to the fact that CETA did not implement some of the projects around the connectivities of the service center, there was no service that was rendered. Therefore, that money could not be paid to CETA, and it resulted in that the understanding, if I can say that. There's another question around the consultancy that the honorable member has raised, that is it possible that investment can dwell with consultants. If we look at that consultancy rate percentage that we spend almost on a yearly basis, and also with this slide, it's about 9.5% of the goods and services or operational budget of the department. We try by all means to make sure that we spend money on consultants on those services that we really don't have in the department. For example, if you look at the previous annual report and the annual report that is coming that will be finalized in July, you find that most of the money that is paid to consultants is around your members of the audit committee, which is a requirement by the PFMA. There's also advisory fees that we pay as legal fees when we have salary negotiations. So we really make sure that we minimize them. And AG as well. So we really try to make sure that we minimize consultancy, the utilization of consultancy as much as possible. It's only on those areas where we don't really have skills. And we try and make sure that we have never, exceeded 10% of the utilization of consultancy against our goods and services or operational budget.
Thank you very much. Allow me just to submit. In conclusion, honorable members, do I have a follow-up question?
Okay. Thank you, Chair. So, Mr. President, you are on the slide 8, page 8, with regards to the charter, what you say to we're going to provide support for the implementation of the charter. I just want to check if there's we have developed a implementation plan because of in other particular places. Other slides were said we're going to virtualize the participation. Also, because the likelihood that if there's an implementation plan, also in the endowment, with regards to the particular person, which is a good program that we said, now we're speaking about revitalizing it. So if we don't have a plan, what is the strategy that the department is going to implement to ensure that this charter is being implemented?
Okay. Honourable members, thank you, Chairperson. Yeah, just the first one, page 16, the top slide, the MTEF budget allocation for programs. I see the
like to know how many public servants are currently doing business with government, and just to see what the impact of the new legislation will be on this department. Will we lose half of our employees, or what will happen? And just, I didn't get it when you said when this new legislation will be implemented by this new legislation avoiding or prohibiting public servants from doing business with government. Thank you, Jim.
Okay. Also, other questions. One of your strategic goals as a department is to provide support and targeted interventions, especially to departments. I just want to check with you. You spoke about Section 100 interventions, and in most instances, these interventions come as a result of failures that occurred, then you come back and try and solve that. What is the proactive mechanisms that the department has in place to ensure that we address that particular challenge? Two, you go all over different spheres. There's quite a number of outstanding cases of disciplinary cases that are still outstanding in the public sector, where you find that people are suspended, even ending their pace. What is the department's strategy to address and speed up that? Any action plan in place, if any? And what is it that you are doing to ensure that you build in-house capacity, particularly for different departments to fast-track these disciplinary cases? The last, in the State of Nation Address, the president of the country spoke at length around issues of job creation. One of the mechanisms that he spoke about was around the increase of intake, particularly for CWP, community development workers. What I want to establish, if we check in terms of accountability, earlier on, the CDWs were accountable to the officers of the speaker through the MEC of COFCA. Currently, they are now located in the premier's offices. And if you check in terms of their programs, ranging from the policy and also the issue of remuneration, is there any policy directive or any institutional alignment in place or anything that you are envisaging to come and address issues that relate to CDW?
Thank you, Chairperson. Because of time, I just want to have one clarity. You are talking about international space in terms of the public service. Are you having any exchange programs between, and what are those countries? Thank you.
I think those are the last questions. Honourable Member, you will be the last one.
Thank you. My last question is on salary discrepancies between the whites and the blacks, where, by example, I will give you an example. If I'm using an administrator, level 3, black woman working with an administrator, level 3, white woman, different salaries. How far are you in that regard as a department to make sure that you close that gap? Thank you.
You shall respond if you want to solicit assistance from your subordinates. Your mother will come to do that, DC.
Thank you. I think let's start with you on the between yourselves and the Public Service Commission this time on the MTF allocations. That's then over to
we do need actually for the outer years of the MTN to get additional funds into the budget. That is correctly pointed out. I do actually have an answer for one of the questions that the member posed about the number of public servants doing business. If I may answer that, Honourable Chairperson. As the DG of the DPSA mentioned, in terms of Chapter 2 of the Public Service Regulations, the financial disclosure forms are submitted to the Public Service Commission. And we have been scrutinizing those forms to pick up areas of conflict of interest or potential conflict of interest. By the financial year end 31st March 2014, we had scrutinized 73% of the forms that had been submitted. That's 9,413 forms, and we picked up 3,386 potential conflicts of interest and 54 actual conflicts of interest. Now, that's not a direct answer to your question, but it's indicative of the number of public servants who are involved in business. Of course, it's not illegal if it is fully declared. The new legislation will outlaw it, but the situation we have at the moment is there needs to be disclosure of those financial interests in businesses, whether they're doing business with government or doing business in the private sector, but interests must be declared. And these numbers do, to some extent, cast light on your question of 9,413 forms, which is 73% of the senior managers' forms. 3,386 potential conflicts of interest were identified, and 54 actual conflicts of interest. So all of those are likely to be doing business with government before the new legislation comes in and outlaws it. I hope that will be helpful. Thank you.
But the question was, should the bill be finalized, what impact will it have? Are we not going to see people opting to go for business instead of remaining in government? I don't understand what the rationale behind it. If you're able to respond to it, but if not, it's fine.
Well, I think both of us could respond to that. I mean, I think... You know, if the bill goes ahead, it will make a difference in terms of the standards of integrity. I mean, we must recognize that senior managers, in particular in government, are earning high salaries, and it's not desirable for them to have other sources of income or interests because they are already earning high salaries. And to focus on their jobs requires 100% focus, not partial focus while they're involved in other activities. Whether or not there'll be a skills flight in the public service, I do not believe it would be like that, because I do believe that the salaries in government are competitive. Of course, there will always be people looking for greener pastures, and some of them may find it in the public service, but I don't think that the bill would have the consequence of sort of enticing people to leave government and go and work in the private sector, because I don't think there would be enough opportunities for a major flight of those skills from government. Thank you.
Honourable Chair, I think just to start with the question about the salary gaps between black and white employees, the system that is being used at the moment doesn't take race into consideration. So where there is a difference in salary between a white employee and a black employee and they are on the same level, it would be because of other considerations, but it wouldn't be race. It might be that on the basis of years of experience, this one has over the years dropped higher notches so that one is level 3, for example, not 5, but another one is level 3, a lower notch, for example. But there can be a lot of reasons, but it's actually not on the basis of race in terms of the way the system works on the issues relating to the charter. Yes, there is a plan for implementation of the charter, and it, actually the revitalization goes beyond the charter. It around the revitalization there are a number of other things. So if you look at the Excellence Award, if you look at the work that gets done around particularly change management programs that we implement, but the detail is there in terms of the revitalization process. And also around the CDWs, just to say that there is a process in place led by our Deputy Minister around dealing with this concern around CDWs and ownership and so on and so on. Just as we are addressing the issue of social service centers, the CDWs one, there is a process led by our Deputy Minister to address that particular area. And exchange programs, they are partnerships between us and various countries where we support each other, and the detail around those as well is available. Thank you so much.
Official suspended pay and also the related mechanism in terms of Section 100.
Yes, I think in terms of the Section 100, what we do, Chairperson is correct, that the Section 100 is much more reactive. But from the monitoring information that we had, for example, one of the things that we'll be doing during 14-15 is look at the monitoring reports that come, for example, from the Department of Performance Monitoring and Evaluation, and look at the performance scores and see what are the departments that seem to be particularly struggling on areas that relate to our mandate. And then we then prioritize them when it comes to the workshops that we've been working on. The suspensions one, the expectation is that because the bill provides for the establishment of a centralized unit to assist departments, if it is passed, the unit will be established and then it will provide that assistance. But in the interim, what we have said ourselves is that we should still create that capacity within the structure.